Hello, hello, hello. Hello, Georgians, hello, global citizens, and hello, concerned Americans. My name is Varun Kadathala, and I'm the current co-host of the Politician Podcast, which myself and my high school best friend Damian Galvin created in June of this year to talk about issues that interest us, issues that disgust us, and issues that America needs to know about. In other words, myself and Damian created this podcast to deconstruct public policy issues of the past and the present and create a more equitable future for all of us. We have a very, very special episode queued up for you guys, but before we play this episode, we're going to give a special thank you to our sponsor, Patreon, and our wonderful team here at Politician, which includes high school juniors Jada Pilling, Yi Shen, and Julia Hartman. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we hope that you enjoy. See you in the episode.
And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Politician. My name is Damian Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Varun Kadathala. As Damian mentioned, I'm the co-host of the Politician Podcast, back for episode 46 here today. We have a very special guest for you once again, Matt Lieberman. He's a candidate for the U.S. Senate from Georgia, and he has a lot to offer for us. You know, thoughts to offer. His election's coming up soon, November 3rd. So it's a very interesting conversation coming up for you guys today. But before we begin, I want to let Matt introduce himself for all of our listeners today. So, Matt, a couple of words from you about yourself.
Well, hey, it's good to be with you guys. I'm excited about this. My name is Matt Lieberman, and I like so many folks in Georgia nowadays, I am a Georgian by choice. We moved here 15 years ago from New Haven, Connecticut originally, went to college and law school at Yale, and started my career there in education, which is what brought us here. And the last 10 years, I've been a small business person and done some other things on the side, a couple startups, wrote a little novel, it's gotten me in a little trouble. And I have two wonderful, beautiful daughters who are 23 and 21. And I'm running for U.S. Senate because things are screwed up. And for whatever reason, I feel uniquely qualified to do something to fix that.
Yeah, and you touched on our next question. This is usually, we have an opening question. I think you'll enjoy our closing question. Most of our guests tend to, but our opening question is always, what drove you, down the career path that you were? Obviously, you started in law, and now you're an aspiring politician. So, what two distinctions kind of drove you down those paths?
Yeah, so my dad is a politician. For your listeners who may not be aware, my dad is Joe Lieberman, who was a longtime U.S. Senator from Connecticut, a Democrat, was Al Gore's vice presidential candidate in 2000, was the Gore-Lieberman ticket. So I grew up, and he was elected to the Connecticut State Senate when I was three. So really, I grew up with my dad in politics, and I'd say I idolized my dad, like many kids do. He is a great guy. And it was just always in my head, I think, just because of that. My mom was a psychiatric social worker for the State Mental Health Center in New Haven, where we grew up. So she was also very community service oriented. So I think I just grew up in a way, it's what I knew. And my dad was a lawyer also. So when I was in college, I didn't really think I wanted to be a lawyer. And in fact, I resisted applying to law school. I remember towards the end of college, it just seemed depressing, frankly, that, you have this very diverse and varied student body at Yale. And it seemed like almost everyone was going into a funnel with three outspouts that were sort of like, law school, maybe it's for law school, medical school, business school, or like, go be an analyst on Wall Street. Like, that's what all those super talented people want to do. There are only four things in the whole world. And so I resisted it. And I actually worked in politics for 1 year in Washington. But I went to law school really with the thought that I thought I'd enjoy it, which I did. I loved it. And that it would prepare me for whatever came next. And although I practiced law very briefly early in my career, just for 2 years, really my career, as I said, has been in education, then business, and now I'm running for office, honestly, just because I feel from growing up with it and truly living my dad's career vicariously in a lot of ways. I've seen the best and the worst of politics. I've seen the best and the worst of public service. I know the focus you need to get things done. There are a lot of good intentions that can get lost between your home state and Washington. People forget what they're there for. And I think my experience with politics and understanding Washington puts me in a uniquely good position to be able to, from the get-go, tune out all the nonsense and focus on the stuff that I need to do for my constituents. And, you know, Washington's a mess. And, you know, I would be there day one knowing that and knowing how I can work not to be just another part of the mess and be actually part of cleaning up the mess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one place in which your dad, who I respect a lot for his viewpoints, but I think you guys both kind of are similar in the fact that you don't follow the wave. I think you guys set the tone. And I think that you've received some backlash from establishment politicians in the Democratic Party. And I think that you both are very similar in keeping with your own viewpoints. I want to talk about where you're different, though. Because I think that you and your dad do have some different viewpoints, as I've seen online. But where do you think you differ from your father on policy issues, anything? Because I think that you know, you've said it before in interviews, you're Matt Lieberman. I want to make our viewers, I want to make them comfortable with who you are as opposed to, you know, your father. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I don't have like a quick and easy answer to, well, he thinks this, I think that, because I truly don't think my way through life that way. And the other thing, honestly, is, you know, while issues remain issues over years and decades, they present themselves in different ways. So, I mean, one of the things that my dad is criticized, that putting it lightly for those who really don't like him, hated, reviled for, is the notion that he single-handedly killed the public option for healthcare when Obamacare passed. And you know, I'm in favor of the public option now, although the way the public option is now being presented by Joe Biden is different from the thing that my dad was opposed to back in 2010. And when we've talked about it, he thinks he'd probably support this version now, which is different from what not just he, but a handful of other Democrats were opposed to. So it's just, it's hard to say. And truly, I don't keep an inventory of where we are on the issues. I think our similarity is in, you know, you can be a strong Democrat. I'm a strong Democrat. I would characterize my platform as really pretty progressive. But, you know, you can also have a backbone. You could have a sense of independence. You know, the greatest example of that is Bernie Sanders, frankly, who, along with my dad, they were the two independent members of the U.S. Senate for quite a number of years, both caucusing with the Democrats, but both with different points of view, and both with an inner core of independence. And I think we need people like that. We need people because it gives people the guts to step out and try to, you know, try to make something good happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, I guess kind of on the similar topic, we do have here in Georgia. Wow, my audio must have gotten quiet again. How odd.
Yeah, it did.
I'm looking at my volumes here. I don't know. We're having some technical difficulties, but nonetheless, I hope that the audience can hear me. I'll try to work with it as we progress. But one of the things that I find confusing, I actually looked at a mail-in ballot the other day, and as early voting has opened up in places around the country, but here particularly in Georgia, could you explain the Senate race? Because I was having a conversation with my dad, and he was like, how are there multiple Democrats on the same ballot? And can you explain? I know that you personally have faced, and other, you know, Democrats and Republicans running on the same ballot have faced, you know, possible backlash because of it. But could you explain how the race actually works for those who don't know?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's a lot of unusual stuff going on this year in Georgia with the U.S. Senate. One, both Senate seats are up for grabs. You have David Perdue, versus John Ossoff. That is what I refer to as the regularly scheduled programming, so to speak. David Perdue is completing his first six-year term and running for re-election. John Ossoff won a Democratic primary, just conventional rules, back in the spring. So it's the two of them and one Libertarian. And then we have this one that I'm in, which is the special election. What happened is Johnny Isaacson, who had been the incumbent for many years, retired in the fall. He's not well with Parkinson's. And under Georgia law, this is what we have. You have a situation where there is no party primary on either in either party. Everyone who wants to run runs against each other. And the first time we're on the ballot is on election day, November 3rd. It's called a jungle primary, which is kind of a crazy, somewhat unsettling name. But in any event, that is what it's called. But it's on election day. So we're all there. There are 20 of us now, roughly halfway split between Democrats and Republicans, or sort of Democrats and sort of left parties and Republicans and right parties. And the top two will advance to a runoff January 5th. And I said, it's conceivably, if someone got 50% of the vote on November 3rd, then there would be no runoff. But that's really impossible with 21 candidates or 20 candidates now. And in fact, the other race with Ossoff and Perdue, which only has three candidates, may very well also have a runoff, again, because to be elected in Georgia, you need someone with 50%. And, you know, that's a close race, and there's a Libertarian in there that will probably drain some votes away from David Perdue. So we could conceivably have, in fact, just today, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution has an article saying it could be a double overtime scenario here in Georgia for the balance of the Senate and the future of the world is what it will seem like. So, in the top two. And it's also mathematically almost a certainty that it will be one Republican and one Democrat will be the top two based on the math. It could be two Republicans or two Democrats, but the math says it's almost certain to be one Republican, one Democrat.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned something that I've believed in for a very long time. This election determines our futures, especially as young kids. This election is extremely important to us. And I wanted to ask you this because I know you've been getting scrutiny for this from establishment Democrats. You're pulling in anywhere from 3% to 10% in the polls. And Raphael Warnock is the front runner right now, receiving endorsements from President Obama, Stacey Abrams, a host of candidates, including one of our past guests, Nikema Williams. I wanted to ask you, you know, looking at your website and Raphael Warnock's website, there's many similarities. I wanted to ask you what makes you different, because I know that I just was confused about why this guy isn't backing Raphael Warnock. And I know there must be some internal reason, but I couldn't get that from looking at your website. So I want you know, to ask you, for our listeners and myself, what makes you different and what holds you back from supporting Raphael Warnock, this guy who's, you know, set to reach the runoff?
Right. Well, I mean, one, one reason I'm not backing him is because I'm running against him. So, you know, that's probably the most basic reason. And it's worth remembering, I was by months the first Democrat in this race, first candidate in this race. I announced for this seat October 3rd of last year. So I've been running for just over a year. Warnock got in the race like February 1st. Mm-hmm. So, and for most of the race, I've been ahead of him. I was ahead of him in probably three quarters of the polls that had come out through the end of July. And then because he has clearly been the chosen candidate of Chuck Schumer and the National Democrats, you know, he's dropped $15 million in TV into the race, and his numbers have gone way up. And now I'm behind, to be sure. But there are a lot of undecided still. And a lot of his support is soft. A lot of his support is folks kind of, frankly, because all they've been doing is seeing his TV ads. And I'm not complaining. I'm just stating reality. I have not been able to raise enough money to have a real presence on TV. We're doing digital stuff, but it's very different. I think a lot of people are just like, oh, he's the Democrat. Yeah, I support him. So that's that's one. I've been in this race longer than anyone. I was ahead in this race until recently. You know, if you think of it like a football game, you could say I was in the lead through the first half. Through the third quarter, you could say we sort of traded leads. And then, you know, he finished the third quarter strong, and he's starting the fourth quarter with a decent lead. Now, his supporters and him, apparently, because he doesn't stop them, think that, okay, we're ahead. It's the start of the fourth quarter. Let's just end it right here. We want to take our ball and go home. Well, you know, to be honest, that's ridiculous, and it's a little entitled. That's not how the system works. It's almost as if they're afraid of the people voting, which is ironic for a Democratic Party that's been all about the people voting. And I think myself and Ed Tarver and the other 8 or 9 Democrats who are staying in the race, you know, America is a democratic system. We vote, and the people choose. It's not the party bosses that choose. And we have had a very heavy-handed presence of the party bosses from Washington and Atlanta. Ultimately, just to circle back to your original question, you know, until a couple months ago, he didn't have any issue section on his website. Now he does. And I think you're probably right. We probably do agree on most of the issues, but he has diligently avoided joint appearances. We're going to have a couple debates coming up, so perhaps we'll flesh those things out. But you know, I think the biggest difference that voters should focus on is that in this race with 20 people, of the top four, I'm the only one who has not been put where I am by some big shot in Washington or Atlanta. You know, Kelly Loeffler's only where she is because of Brian Kemp. Doug Collins is only where he is because he got a wink and a nod from Donald Trump. And Warnock's only in this race, he's only even running because Chuck Schumer said, here, you can have it. And I'm only where I am because people have been listening and have been indicating through polls their support. And of course, it's not any of our seat. It's your seat. And ultimately, you are the ones that choose. It's not Chuck Schumer, Brian Kemp, or Donald Trump. So I'm putting my faith in the people of Georgia. And the people of Georgia should know that if I'm their senator, I will be working for them and only for them, not for someone in Washington or Atlanta, only for them.
Yeah. And I mean, listen to what you said. It is inspiring. But I wanted to address one of your claims, being afraid of a challenger. I think many Georgians right now are more afraid of Donald Trump, his appointee, Kelly Loeffler, Doug Collins, two big Trumpies, you know, coming into the U.S. Senate from Georgia. And I think that's what people are afraid of more. So I want to ask you this question. How do you plan on regaining that lead, which you had before? And now, as you were saying, you're pulling lower than you had before. How do you plan on regaining that lead before November 3rd? Because there's time. I want to see if it's, you know, what's your game plan going into November 3rd?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, look, given the extremely lopsided amount of money that Warnock's campaign has and I have, and given that he has jumped out to a lead, it's a long shot right now. I mean, I've been around politics long enough. Either he will advance to the runoff or he'll collapse for some reason. Now, people collapse in politics. Stuff comes out, whatever. There are reasons people collapse. You've been around politics long enough, you see any number of crazy things happen. In fact, you know, my dad's first election to the U.S. Senate in 1988, he was 18 points behind with 3 weeks to go. And he won by a little less than 1%. So I've lived through that kind of comeback, and I know it can happen for various reasons. So we'll see what happens. But yeah, he's in a commanding position. But again, it is remarkable. The folks who, you know, his supporters and his campaign, they're not challenging me on issues or what's best for the future of the state of Georgia or on who speaks more strongly for our values and our priorities. They're just saying, you don't even have a right to be here. You're doing a disservice to just by running, which is, I'd say it's a little bit nauseating, honestly. I mean, they're not taking me up on any issues. They're just saying, get out. And that is un-American. In my view, that's like a totalitarian response. And I can assure everyone, by the way, and you know, look, I've been trying to assure everyone of this, but I think people who support Warnock, they don't want to hear it. But I know you guys said you just did your PSAT or SAT stuff, so you have math in your head. So here's the math of this race. If the number two Democrat is at 10%, let me back up. We're in a purple state. Democrats are around 50%, Republicans are around 50%. In this situation, it's overwhelmingly likely that the top two will be the top Democrat and the top Republican, the top person in, from each of those 50% pools. And just to go give you some hypotheticals, if the number two Democrat is at 10%, the number one Democrat is going to be at 30 to 35%. And then the rest of the Democrats will get 5 to 10%. 30 to 35% is absolutely advancing to the runoff. If the number two Democrat is at 15%, the number one Democrat is going to be at 25 to 30%. And the rest of the Democrats in the field will split 5 to 10%. 25 to 30%, again, mathematically, is absolutely going to be in the runoff. Now, if the number two Democrat is actually kind of tied with the number one Democrat at around 20%, 21%, 22%, then it's a totally different race. Then neither of those Democrats can truly say, well, hey, you know, you're raining on my parade or whatever. Then you have two strong candidates. And again, it's a democracy. The people decide this. With all respect to Stacey Abrams, Nkema Williams, and everyone who's been saying, oh, shoo, get out of the race. It's not your time. It's not your moment. Disappear. That's ridiculous. That's not how the system works. And there is no threat that it's going to be two Republicans going forward, unless the only way it could happen would be if all four top candidates were virtually tied. That's really the only way it could happen. And somehow the two Republicans just edged out the two Democrats. So that is it. I'm telling you, I've thought about this more than anyone.
We can tell, and trust me, I think the people of Atlanta definitely know that a lead isn't a lead until the game's over. So it wouldn't be fair to say that you're out of the race any means. And I think that's honestly, I think that you speak to Democratic values in saying that you're representing, because 10% of Georgians, you know, by the, you know, going saying you get 10% of the votes, want you to be the senator. And by you choosing not to put your name, you know, on the ballot, they're not having fair representation, and you're really giving them that equal opportunity, which is, I would argue, even more crucial than anything else. Because again, you know, the Democratic Party does keep saying, you know, vote, it's your voice. You know, use your voice. This is the time to use your voice. But it wouldn't be fair for them to voice their opinion on a candidate that they have none for.
I'm with you. And look, you know, it cannot be a healthy thing in a democracy to try to run people out of races, try to scare them out of campaigns. The answer to whatever is ailing a democracy can't be telling someone, get the heck out of here, you shouldn't even be running in the first place. It's just not healthy. It's not what it's about. And I think, look, I'm dealing with this now with the Democratic power brokers in Atlanta and Washington. It absolutely exists on the Republican side as well. You know, I think we have a problem here, and part of it's because politics is such a war now. And no one can even really imagine working with folks in the other party, which you have to do to get something done. But, you know, when Donald, these folks telling me to get out of the race is as distrustful of the people as the Republicans' efforts to suppress the vote.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think really in both cases, you have people who they kind of believe in democracy as long as it's producing the result they want. But when put to the test, I think what both on the right and the left, what these reactions kind of show you is, you know, it's almost like they're more like frustrated totalitarians. Really what they want is, you know, they what they want is what they want. And they don't really care about the process if it's not working for them. They'll trample on the process if it's not working for them. And it's upsetting as a Democrat because the Democratic Party in Georgia and Stacey Abrams, obviously, you know, have been champions of democracy. Yeah. And now, you know, now it's they're singing a different tune because for whatever reason, they're scared of me. I don't know why, you know, why they want me gone.
Yeah. And, you know, just a question kind of on that line, because I guess there's no like kind way to word this, but why would you still say that you align with the Democratic Party and as opposed to being an independent?
Well, you see, because I do, because issue by issue, I mean, there are a few exceptions. I am for wide open public school choice. So I favor the creation of more charter schools than most Democrats. And I favor things like the state tax credit program we have in Georgia that creates scholarship pools for students, more students to be able to afford to go to private school. I favor something like that on the federal level, a tax credit program like that on the federal level. And there are other differences, small, between me and I guess national Democratic orthodoxy, but issue by issue. I mean, I'm a Democrat. The fact that you might have to consider being an independent or calling yourself an independent, because not because of differences on the issues, but because the heavy-handedness of the party bosses is an indictment of the heavy-handedness of the party bosses. You know, it's and right now, you know, I say, look, I think there's a lot of gutlessness in politics. I mean, I've said that. I think we have a pandemic of gutlessness in politics. I think in each party, everyone is sort of, if you picture two opposite walls in the room, each party is clinging to opposite walls because politically, those are the safe spaces. If you wander away from your wall, either on an issue or two, or just get into a, you know, power struggle with whoever the boss is, you expose yourself to a politician's worst nightmare, which is if you're an incumbent, is a primary from someone to your left or someone else that the party's going to support to get rid of you. And politicians, you know, I think the corruption in Washington is not so much greed. In my experience, politicians don't go to Washington to make money. They could almost all make money, more money, if they didn't go to Washington.
Yeah.
It's a corruption of fear. They are corrupted by their fear. And so they sort of swallow their better instincts of service, and their political instincts prevail. And their political instinct is to stay on those opposite walls and just stay down with the pack. And so I can be a Democrat, but I don't want to stay with the pack. You know, I want to be a bit heterodox, if you will. And we shouldn't be in a world where you have to be 100%. In fact, Obama said this a few years ago. You know, enough of these purity tests, enough of this cancel culture. It doesn't serve any good.
Yeah. And Damien, I think you have some background, so if you want to cut down upon that.
Yeah, I mean,
you have a lot of background noise, Damien.
Oh, do I? Oh, do I?
Yeah, you just went up. Your audio went up. I think we're good now.
Am I? All right, okay,
perfect.
Awesome.
So, yeah, a little bit technical issues, but I wanted to speak on what you said, Matt. I mean, absolutely right. I think that I've learned a lot from just talking to you, but I think that there's two sides to the issue. You know, number one, as you mentioned, we have a right to run for public office. You have a right to run for public office. You know, I see where Nikema Williams is coming from. I think that she's well-intentioned. We have people who are possibly losing reproductive rights, healthcare rights, voting rights. If Kelly Loeffler and Doug Collins become the nominee to the Senate, you know, going up to the U.S. Senate puts everything in jeopardy, especially because, as I said before, as you said, this election is extremely important. So I think that, you know, we have to respect both sides of the issue, and it begins with having real debates. I think that the bigger issue right now is what I would say as having debates about the facts, and not necessarily things that people are, you know, it is baseless is what I'm going to say. I think we have to have more debates, tell more people about what, and that's why I contacted you for the podcast, because I looked at the candidates that we have for our district, and I'm seeing that you're polling relatively high. I wanted to ask what your standpoints are and you know, address some controversy. So in the act of addressing controversy, I want to talk about what, again, many establishment Democrats are pushing. And I saw it off a HuffPost article over earlier this week. It was your book, Lucius. And, you know, as I looked at it before, we see many establishment Democrats and people from across the board saying you use racist tropes. You know, there's multiple N-word references in the book. I wanted to ask you for your perspective, because I think that what we're missing is perspective. And then we can dive into it. But what is your perspective on what Democrats are saying, people are saying about your book, and what was your intention writing this book?
All right. Well, just first, for the excitement of your listeners, a little inside politics background. Everyone, the DSCC, the National Democratic Party, knew about my books for over a year, and they hadn't said anything. And I'll talk about the book in a second. Monmouth University came out with another poll showing me ahead of Warnock right at the end of July, around, I think, 14-9. The reporter from the AJC was doing an article about how I was doing well in the race. The folks in Washington heard about it, and within a day and a half, the Huffington Post thing came out. It was ready to come out. They just waited for their moment. And then the same day, in synchronized fashion, both, you know, Nkema Williams accused me of racism and said there was no place for that in the Democratic Party and there would be consequences. And James Woodall, the head of the NAACP, called for me to drop out of the race. I invited James to an open town hall meeting to discuss issues of race and other issues of importance to communities of color and to all of us, like police reform, like systemic bias in our biggest systems of government and how we can address those. He hasn't taken me up on that offer. So I just want to pause here for a second just to note that part of their response to me, a Democrat, issue by issue, a pretty progressive Democrat doing well in this race, was to accuse me of racism, which you may have noticed, not that being called a racist has ever been a particularly good thing, you know, certainly in our lifetimes. It's yeah. Particularly not a good thing right now, and it's absurd and utterly baseless. So to the book. The book I wrote as in revulsion with what happened to Charlottesville, as someone, as an American, as a white person, also as a Jew, you know, and the Jewish people were targeted by the chants and the racism at Charlottesville, the bigotry at Charlottesville as well, the swastikas and everything. I just couldn't understand. I could understand it. Look, as someone who's Jewish, I have a view of bigotry. Well, it's colored by my Jewish experience. And it says that, you know, that kind of hatred is never going to go away. That is what Jewish history tells us. But in this country, which has been so great, ultimately, for Jewish Americans and other immigrant groups as well, It was surprising. It felt like something, again, with the stars and bars and the swastikas, it felt like something that crawled out from under a rock that had been like buried decades ago. And there it was in this lovely college town of Charlottesville. And I couldn't understand it. So I had this story in my head and I wrote a short novel. And it's an anti-racist novel. But it's about racism in large measure. And so, of course, there are racist characters. And the racist characters think and say racist things. And so my opponent, Reverend Warnock, and his campaign take that and call me a racist. because I wrote a story against racism with racist characters who say racist things, of course, given that they're racist. And so apparently that makes me a racist. It can't be that a white person can't write particularly an anti-racist story about race and racism. It can't be.
Yeah.
I understand. You know, so it was disappointing, you know, in some ways. Look, I don't know if anyone saw the movie Jojo Rabbit, which actually won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay, but it's set in Nazi Germany. Yeah. And, you know, it's sort of, there's a little boy who has an imaginary friend who's Hitler. And Hitler yeah. is made into sort of a friendly buffoon-like character. And, you know, I'm Jewish. It's a little bit uncomfortable to watch Hitler being portrayed as anything other than Hitler. But, you know, you got at the same time understand the guy who did the movie is making a point. He's making a point about yeah. why people resort to such corrupt thinking. And that's what I was trying to do as well. But, you know, the other thing to say, I hope my answers aren't too long, but the other thing to say briefly is that if you look at that article in Huffington Post, which was something a cross between a book review and a political hatchet job, and then if you look at the review in that you can find online at KirkusReviews.com, when the book was written, and read both reviews, right there you could see the difference between how someone looks at a book just as a book by an author versus how someone looks at a book if it's in the context of a political campaign and a hatchet job. So
yeah.
I would invite people to do that.
Yeah. You know, I saw your Kirkus Books review before I saw Huffington Post. You know, I saw that, and it was, it's very stark, the contrast. I can attest to it. And before I can, you know, before Damien continues, I did watch Jojo Rabbit. And now that you mention it, I think that there's very stark parallels between what your book was and what Jojo Rabbit is. Before I read Huffington Post's review, and I think you confirm my suspicion, I think that it's a very big political hatchet job. I think that your book is something, my father writes book like novels like these, other short stories about how, you know, it's very indirect references to what's happening right now in our country. And I think that sometimes when these things are taken in the most literal context with no literary analysis, yes, it may seem as racist or things like or xenophobic. But I think when you actually look at the context in which you wrote it, I agree. I think that it's absolutely similar. But Damien, continue.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say it's almost as if there was a novel in like eighth grade that we all read that was written by a white woman that says the N-word multiple times, and I may or may not just have the sequel to that novel sitting right in front of me. And it, again, it's an anti-racist. I'm talking about, for those who haven't gotten the reference, I'm talking about both Ghost at a Watchman and To Kill a Mockingbird, which are, I mean, both books shaped my view on race drastically. It shaped me into the person where it's almost as seeing, you know, I guess what I picked up from the moral, you know, there's the quote that says you won't understand a man till you, you know, walk, you know, literally get into his skin and walk in it. And all of that really shaped my perspective on what would happen years later, you know, several years later now, almost 3 years after I read the first novel. And I actually read Ghost at a Watchman as everything was happening in relation to the George Floyd case. And Harper Lee by no means is an African-American scholar or, you know, she didn't write, she wasn't by any means African-American, but her views on them, I think, are just as qualified to give me perspective, at least. It's unfortunate because I think, what if Harper Lee ran for office? You know, if she would have run for office, these works would have been seen as, you know, groundbreaking. And they would have been seen as something that really, I think even, you know, from the Democratic Party, propelled her into the national spotlight. But it's the stark contrast. And again, if you would have been the front runner, or if you would have been Chuck Schumer's, you know, pick, would this have happened?
They could have just as easily spun it as someone who was anti-racist and
woke,
a white guy who actually sat down and spent a ton of time writing a book as a signal of anti-racism, you know, 3 years before the public at large was really even thinking about anti-racism. It could be spun that way, but that, of course, doesn't suit the purposes of the folks who are supporting Reverend Warnock, and so it wasn't. It's politics, so sort of all's fair, but I think, and I know who I am, so it doesn't really hit me personally that way, but it does bother me as a citizen, because it's the worst of politics, in my opinion, these accusations. I can tell you, just from talking to Ed Tarver, who I talked to some, one of the other Democrats in the race, who's consistently polled, you know, well below me almost always, he has been invited to way more Democratic county committee meetings than I have. And I believe it's largely because a lot of people took up Nakima Williams on what she said, that there would be consequences and that there wasn't a place for my kind of racism, whatever that is, in the Democratic Party. And I think as a result, a lot of people just didn't invite me to talk. And that's a loss all around. We did polling right away, and I know that I think in the abstract, the racism criticisms didn't really impact people, particularly when they understand that I invited the head of the NAACP to talk about the issues in a constructive way, when they understand it's an anti-racism novel written in the wake of Charlottesville. People want leaders, and they want themselves to be able to have good faith, open conversations without fear of blowback. And I'm wide open to that. You know, I would talk all day about these issues, if allowed to, but apparently the message from the machine is that I shouldn't be allowed to. So we go forward, but I just know that's not where most of the people are. Most of the people, there's so much, and this is a bigger point about the moment we're at with the need for police reform and other things. There's so much goodwill out there right now that could result in meaningful change. And I feel there's a significant risk in blowing it if the movement comes across as kind of grading its allies. Like, no, you're not an ally in the way we need you to be an ally. There's only one way to be an ally. I actually wrote a piece that's on Medium, which is called Calling an Ally Racist, which I feel is what happened in my case. Mm-hmm. And it's disturbing. And again, it's a symptom of this this culture of purity test that, again, President Obama decried probably 3 or 4 years ago.
Absolutely. And I think that I was just going to say before I let Varun continue here, we talk about cancel culture all the time. And I think that was the point that Varun was going to run on. We talk about this idea, and it takes me... I always have this image, right? And I think that the Republican Party is just as guilty of it as the Democratic Party. But it's this idea where it's like you have to check every box and fit in perfectly, or else you're not woke, or else you have to get out. And it's this idea of, you know, there's the whole conversation about reform. But is it really reform if you're just kicking everyone out? You know, it's the same thing with prison reform. If we're just sending prisoners who, you know, who have committed crimes against our society to jail and just keeping them there for a certain amount of time instead of actually reforming them to become valiant and you know, hardworking members of our society? Are we really doing our jobs as Americans? And it comes back to this, the reason that we started this podcast, which is to have, you know, perspective, have conversations, because I could have read the piece from the Huffington Post and formulated my own opinion without ever having heard your side of it. And it's this idea that, you know, just because you maybe, you know, maybe I walk away from reading that article with a bad perception of you, but I have to be just as open to giving whoever that may be another chance or really understanding where they came from, just as they have to be open to changing their opinion that caused me to think of them in that same way. And we have this hyper-partisanship that we really have been, I mean, running on since, I think, you know, we talk about it in a couple episodes. I think it was, you know, Mitch McConnell, that's who I think really did it. But it's almost, from your perspective, you know, as Americans, we see it as hyper-partisan, or, you know, the divide between the Republican and the Democratic Party, but it looks like there's almost even a divide between the party itself. So I'd love to hand it over to Varun.
Yeah, hit it right on the bell. I think that I was going to mention our cancel culture discussions from earlier. I think one of the biggest things that comes from cancel culture is the inability of our party to listen. And of Americans to listen. You know, when I saw your Huffington Post thing, like Damian said, obviously being on the podcast, being podcasters and being concerned Americans, we didn't want to just take it as reality. And my first instinct was to say, hey, can we have Matt Lieberman on the podcast? And like I said, I contacted Kelly Loeffler, I contacted Doug Collins, and I contacted Raphael Warnock. I only heard back from one person, and that's you. And I think that it hit back on your perspective about being the only person out of the four leading contenders in this race who is fighting for Americans and Georgians, and, you know, Georgians of every kind. So I think that it hits back on that point. And I think I just want to ask you, you know, as a general thing, how do we stop cancel culture, not just cancel culture, but how do we allow people to give their perspective without receiving blowback? Because I think that one of the goals of politics today should be to encourage people to learn and to become better. And right now, it seems awfully a lot like it's more about conforming than it is actually helping people. So how do we create more political discussion and, you know, not alienate third party candidates, even Democrats who are not part of the establishment, from running in races? Because that's a real issue.
It is a real issue. And I don't know for sure what will work. I guess I can tell you what I hope to be able to do and what this campaign itself is an effort at doing. You know, even before everyone started, by everyone I mean the Democratic sort of activist base, started getting angry at me for continuing to exist in the race, maybe just for continuing to exist. Even before that, there was a lot of pressure. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? It's, you know, you're not supposed to be doing this. Everyone's supporting Warnock. Da 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 da. It's just, again, it's this pandemic of gutlessness. You just need people who are unafraid. And, you know, it's very telling. Georgia has a remarkable opportunity with this special election race, because typically, you know, you only get one Democrat and one Republican running in November. Because of this rule, you have more than that. And so, you know, people have an opportunity to choose from more than just the same two flavors that are always on the menu. Mm-hmm. By virtue of this process, you know that everyone else, particularly on the Democratic side, because the Republicans don't seem to be worried about this as much, but everyone else on the Democratic side, they're truly running as citizens who want to make our state better. Because none of us has received encouragement. We've received the opposite of encouragement from the party machine. But the law allows us all to be in there, and we're in there. And, you know, as I've said, the other three are really just, there are a lot of other Democrats I know that wanted to run. You know, Mike Thurmond, who's the CEO of DeKalb County, Jen Jordan, they were all told not to, and they didn't, because they're politicians. They're professional politicians. They're good people, but they don't want to screw up their career. You need people who, for whom this isn't life or death in a professional way, to weigh in, to get in there. And so, look, I'm on a little bit of a kamikaze mission, I guess. I mean, it's not a kamikaze mission because the goal is not for the plane to explode as it hits a ship. But but you have to have a fearlessness, and you have to be willing to take, you have to have thick skin and be willing to take a lot of flack. And ultimately, you just got to hope that you can get there. And then you have to have the guts to take a few steps out and out onto that middle ground and find people in the other party to come over. And you just need some people to start doing that. You just got to, and I ultimately, the public, I think, wants that. The problem is that the parties are only giving people two very predictable flavors of candidates. And I think a lot of people look at who's running each year and say, you know, why is there never someone running who I really feel great about? And it's because you're getting these sort of, if you think of it in food terms, you're getting two highly processed food items put in front of you, and that's it. And
yeah.
And so it takes guts. You just got to be willing to take some crap, and you got to be willing to work, reach across the aisle when you get there. And, you know, one of the things is you got to, the whole point of this is to serve the public and to actually produce for the people you're representing. The way things are now, you need the president in one party, the House in the same party, and 60 senators in the Senate to get anything big done if we stay this partisanly opposed to each other. And yeah, that happens like two out of every 40 or 35 years. So if our government at the federal level is only going to get anything big done two out of 35 years, that's not great. And that's, I mean, the only way that we can do better than that is if people are willing to break out of these partisan molds and work together again.
Absolutely. And I think that you brought up a lot of incredible points that we need to take, you know, we can word into even being Americans, right? This goes outside of politics. This goes into how you see members of your own community, and how we can perceive each other as neighbors, as students, as even family members. I'm sure that there's some situations that can relate to even that. But with that being said, Mr. Lieberman, I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And as we do with all our guests, I want to ask you one final question. And that is, if you had one thing, one saying, one message, one quote that you would leave to America's youth from you, what would it be? Take your time with it. We've had some guests take 5 minutes on the pod,
absolutely.
5 minutes of silence on the podcast.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, it's an important question.
This is a good silence, you know. Take your time, please.
I would say don't unnecessarily close doors on yourself. And don't believe that doors are closed before you've tried them. Work hard. Get yourself qualified and skilled. If there's one thing you know you want to do, pursue it with a passion. If you don't have the foggiest idea what you want to do, work hard still, qualify yourself still. Know you're not the only one. You may be in the majority. And again, knock on those doors and see if they open.
Absolutely. And,
yeah.
And one door that we have open and that we're trying to open for some members in our community, as most of you will know now that we're wrapping up the podcast, is the Toy Drive initiative that we're doing here at Politeen. We're working to get kids in low-income communities some toys. I think me and Varun have a goal of about $1,000 on our GoFundMe. You guys can go check that out on our link tree. We already have 160 wooden toys, as you guys saw on the last episode. We talked to our guests who donated those to us, and an amazing story and an amazing episode. So please be sure to check that out if you haven't already. And as always, thank you, Varun, for adding amazing quality to this conversation, asking amazing questions, and, you know, inciting exciting conversation, as we hope to do with every single one of our listeners. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, be sure to tune in to our next episode coming out, let's see, this Friday, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's next Monday, Damien.
Okay, Monday. So this one's this one's coming out Friday. Yeah. Apologies, guys. This one's coming out Friday, and we'll have another episode for you guys Monday. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, thank you guys so much for tuning in. Goodbye.
Hello, 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 everybody. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Politician Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, head on over to www.patreon.com/politician podcast for more exclusive members-only content, special episodes, and merch drops. That is, once again, www.patreon.com/politician podcast. I'm going to make it a jingle when I grow up. It is www.patreon.com/politician podcast. No, I'm just kidding, you guys. But definitely visit www.politician podcast.com. For more amazing content from myself, Damien, our team, our amazing artwork head, and our sponsors over at Politician. And once again, thank you so much for watching today's episode. Thank you to my co-host, Damien Galvin, for an amazing conversation, my friend. I do appreciate your input, as always. And that said, have a great rest of your weekend. Chime in for the next episode, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation.